Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Today, we are marking the one-year anniversary of the January 6th attacks. We know every media outlet is discussing this, but we're hoping to have a different conversation about what happened that day, where we're headed, and much-needed historical context. Today's guest, historian Nancy McLean, says if we don't reckon with the deep historical roots of what happened this time last year, those events could be prologue to a far worse outcome in the future. Nancy McLean is an award-winning historian and distinguished professor of history and public policy at Duke University. Her most recent book is Democracy in Chains, The Deep History of the Radical Right's Stealth Plan for America. She explores how over six decades, the radical right has worked to not only change who rules, but to fundamentally alter the rules of democratic governance as we know it. Hi, Nancy. Thank you so much for joining us again.
Hi, Rose. It's great to be with you.
Well, we are so glad to have you for the hour on this day. And so many outlets are focusing on January 6th. Of course, what happened over the last year and the 4 years under Trump is so, so important. But I'm really not hearing that much about historical context. Nancy, why is that so important to focus on?
Yes, that is so true, Rose. It's really important to understand the history behind this because, you know, while for most Americans and others, you know, abroad who watched the horrible events of January 6th play out, they were so shocking and it seemed like such a break with tradition, which it was. It was the first time we saw armed resistance at the Capitol to the peaceful transfer of power in our history, you know, and there was a horrific violence, you know, visited on people in the Capitol, on the police who were trying to hold the line against the mob, you know. There were threats, of course, of lynching of the vice president and Nancy Pelosi and others. So it was, you know, quite a day of drama and shock for all of us. But I think what we miss in focusing on our own responses to this or on the immediate perpetrators of that violence is that for the perpetrators, this was not a failure. It was a culmination. It was a calculated gambit. And even in the future, we could see that this was a trial run for a coup that could well succeed in 2024 with the laws that this MAGA faction of the Republican Party that now dominates it are passing in the states that they control.
So let's talk a little bit about historical context, because your book does an amazing job of really looking at what has happened over the last six decades. And you write about Nobel Prize winning economist James McGill Buchanan, who really focused on disempowering the majority. You write that without Buchanan's ideas and the Koch's money, the libertarian cause would not have succeeded in taking over the Republican Party. So what do we need to know about James McGill Buchanan and really what he put into place over the last six decades?
Yeah, I think that's really important for people to know about, because while many, you know, wonderful investigative journalists, you know, above all Jane Mayer, but, you know, she's not alone. Many other people have tracked the money trail that has so polluted our politics and so transformed the Republican Party and radicalized it to the right. What very few people understand is the strategy that's ultimately driving this and how the various particular policies that they have put in place over a long period of time, but especially over the last decade, how those are serving a larger strategy to, you know, in the title of my book puts it, put democracy in chains, but we could also say to shackle the majority will in our country. And of course, we're seeing this in place over place, you know, issue over issue in our public life, that even though vast majorities want action on the climate, we don't get there. Even though majorities want action on racial equity, we don't get it. Even though the vast majority thinks the wealthy should be taxed much more to essentially save our economy and provide for the common good, that doesn't happen. So there's all these particular domains where we see this play out. But what I learned in the research for my book is that it actually comes out of a particular system of thought developed by this James McGill Buchanan, who was the first U.S. Southerner honor to win the Nobel Prize in Economic Sciences. And he actually won the prize for research that he did in the civil rights era in Virginia, in essentially strategizing for how to help this old South elite that was anti-New Deal, anti-civil rights, very pro-corporate, to hold on to power. And over the years, he developed those ideas more and more. He came to the attention of Charles Koch in 1970, worked with him in another number of operations thereafter. And Koch, since then, has weaponized Buchanan's ideas into a strategy to do this work of enchaining democracy. So you mentioned, at the outset of the show that Buchanan's advice to people on the right was to stop focusing on who rules and pay attention to the rules and to change the rules to get the outcomes you wanted. And we've seen the Koch network push this strategy through the hundreds of organizations they fund and through this Republican Party that they have captured for their agenda, with things like voter suppression, the most radical gerrymandering we've ever seen in American political history, the most sophisticated gerrymandering, the building up of a massive media echo chamber of disinformation and fraud on the right, led by Fox News, but of course, encompassing many other outlets, organizations that have worked to change the courts and the law and understanding of the Constitution, such as the Federalist Society, which of course also some of its members were the source of the legal doctrine that informed the coup planners. So they were saying that they would get the state legislatures to buck the will of the majority of the people, refuse to certify the election, and throw the election to Congress, where each state would only have one vote, not votes in proportion to population. So I could go on there, but that's some of the way that story of the reaction against the civil rights movement and the New Deal in Virginia in the late 1950s and early 1960s laid the groundwork for what we have seen since, and particularly dramatically on January 6, 2021.
I wonder what you think about this conversation around democracy, Nancy. So many media outlets are talking about, what's in store for the future of U.S. democracy? Where is our democracy going? What does that mean exactly? Because I even think about this study that came out in 2014 from Princeton University that found this is not a democracy, because as you say, the people want one thing and the politicians do the opposite. Mostly Republicans, but also Democrats. The wealthy few move policy while the average American has little power. So what does democracy even mean when you're talking about the United States?
Yeah, I mean, I think, most of your listeners will understand that we, have never had a full democracy. For generations, we had the exclusion of the majority of the population from the franchise, including the enslaved and then free African-American women, women of all groups from the time of the Constitution forward, and we could go on. So there's always been that, but there is also kind of the corporate capture of so much of our politics and of our courts. So there's lots of reasons for people to feel frustrated with or even cynical about the phrase American democracy. But I would argue that this is a moment when we have to kind of regenerate our batteries and realize that as flawed as it is, what we now have could be reformed and could be made to work for the will of the people. If this MAGA faction succeeds in taking over all branches of the government, and if they win the midterms in 2022 and gain control of Congress as well as more control over the states, they will lead us to an authoritarian future. I don't even have to say might. I think we can say will, based on what they've been doing in the states since 2021, they have worked to lay the legal groundwork to enable them to effectively steal future elections. So they're trying hard to suppress the vote. They're again gerrymandering, and they are trying to change in the states that the Republican Party controls the way that elections are run and that votes are counted, and to put in partisan MAGA, you know, Trump supporters into those offices in order to control the elections. So I think that we have to do what Bruce Springsteen once said, and that is never forget the country in your heart, right? There's the real country that we wake up to every morning, but also, as Langston Hughes put it, the America that never was yet must be. So I think we have to keep working, because I think this is a moment, one of those precipice moments where we could be pushed further back into worse reaction than any of us can actually frankly imagine, or we could break through this crust of the kind of billionaire right-wing white supremacist kind of reaction that has been impeding us for so long. If we mobilize in larger numbers and strategically enough, then I think the whole equation could be changed, and we could begin to ensure that government becomes responsive to the vast majority of the people who actually want a lot of similar things. So definitely there's reason to feel deeply, deeply frustrated about the state of what is called American democracy. And I think, you know, no one channels that better than Bernie Sanders, or speaks to that, you know, and offers that critique, and, you know, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. And yet I think it's also important for people to remember that those two have stuck in the game, right? Mm-hmm. They're still working, they're still fighting, and there is a strategy. There are democracy reform measures coming up now. They've already passed the House. They're coming up in the Senate this month, the For the People Act and the John Lewis voter I'm spacing out the last two words of it, but the John Lewis Act and the For the People Act. These are really important democracy reforms. And I think it's vital for, you know, folks like your listeners and all the people that I tend to speak with in these things to pay attention to those measures, to push hard and make their voices heard so that we pass that democracy reform. And that passing that will require at least suspending the filibuster that has blocked so much progress in this country and is a holdover of the Jim Crow era. So I think even the mere passage of these measures, you know, in breaking the filibuster, will be a huge step in the right direction toward a kind of freedom from the domination we've been experiencing.
Given that you are a historian, Nancy, and you have looked at social movements that have worked in the past, can you elaborate on what you think will work? Because there is just so much really devastating news that hits us on a daily basis. I mean, yes. Statistics about voter suppression. NPR just found that 15 Republicans who've denied or cast doubts on the election results are running to be the chief election officer in 12 states. We've heard about all of the death threats against mm-hmm. election officials that are just trying to do their jobs, healthcare workers, of course. I mean, every day there's something, right? And we all yes. kind of, it's almost like when you're driving and you see a crash, you don't want to look at it, but you do. So mm-hmm. when one of these far right Congress people say something that's just off the wall, there's so much media attention. I mean, it's head spinning. So
yes.
Right. And we're all part of it. What would you say would actually work based on yeah. what has worked in the past?
Yeah, I love the way you describe it. what so many of us are feeling. It's just so frustrating. And to toss the pandemic on top of that right. and the fact that this Republican Party and the Koch donor network has brought us to this point by turning people against vaccines, by, you know, lobbying against important public health measures, taking away powers from governors to act on the pandemic. So absolutely, we are all, you know, in a state of high frustration. administration. And as you say, we're bombarded with this bad news. I would say, and I'm glad you gave me the chance to say this, I would say that it's really important for people to screen out a bit of that 24/7, you know, bombast. And you know, you don't really need to know the latest awful thing Marjorie Taylor Greene did or Bobart or Gosar, or, you know, you kind of keep them in the dim background and instead think about what you can do, right? Each one of us who cares about majority rule, who cares about the climate, who cares about racism, who cares about gender equity, who cares about, you know, fairness for working people, all of us have networks of people that we know from different parts of our lives. We have talents. We have passions. And I think what we need to do is kind of lift our eye, or, you know, move our eyes away from that horizon of all that cacophony of bad news and say, what can I do? How can I get involved? How can I contribute to changing this? And it will be different things for different people. You know, for some people, it will be, you know, getting involved with a voter group and making calls, perhaps even in purple states, you know, to ensure voter turnout for the midterms. For others, you know, might be very, very busy, but might have money to give. Other people might be writing letters to their local newspaper, because most people do trust their local papers more than they trust the national press at this point. For other people, it could be doing the kind of deep canvassing that Stacey Abrams and others did so brilliantly in Georgia to get us our two senators there, Ralph Warnock and John Ossoff. Huge victories that no one would have anticipated, that we could easily forget about. So they're, you know, even doing popular education in organizations that you're part of, you know, set up a democracy book club to help people know what's going on. Or even just, you know, build small groups of people who work together in the local community to alert others to what's happening. There is more than enough for all of us to do. And there's a big cosmic division of labor out there, I've learned too. You know, so you can do what you can do with an eye to the big picture, but you don't have to feel like you have to do everything in this, right? So I think the crucial thing is just to get involved and to start connecting with others and to be a part of this. And the most immediate way, again, that people can make that difference is making sure that we get this new legislation passed through the Senate in January, the For the People Act, which, you know, people can look up, but it does all kinds of wonderful, wonderful things to make for a functional democracy and would stop all this nonsense that the right is trying to do. And also the John Lewis Act, named in honor of the veteran of the Southern student civil rights struggle, John Lewis, and later congressman who sadly died not long ago.
Today, we're speaking with Nancy McLean, an award-winning historian and distinguished professor of history and public policy at Duke University. Her most recent book is Democracy in Chains, The Deep History of the Radical Right's Stealth Plan for America. It is a must-read, and you can find the interview we did with Nancy about this book. We had her on a few times to talk about it at yourcallradio.org. If you have any questions or comments for Nancy McLean about historical context, where we are, where we're going, we'd love to hear from you. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org or tweet at yourcallradio. You know, talking about getting involved at the local level, a number of reports have focused on people who were at the attacks, who kind of decided to lay low and really get involved at the local level, whether it's school boards or, you know, conspiracy theorists running for election boards. So what are your thoughts about that, and how can people counter that?
Yeah, I'm so glad that you raised that, Rose. The right has already shown that an important frontal element of its strategy going into 2022 and perhaps onward to 2024 is to weaponize racism and stir up kind of non-existent controversies at the local level and even within particular schools. And I've been contacted by some people who, you know, whose kids are in schools and they're fighting these right-wing crazies, you know, spreading misinformation and attacking school board members and teachers and principals and even the students themselves. So I would say very much watch out for that. You know, I think most of the listeners of the show will know that the kind of fig leaf language that these attacks are proceeding under is what they call critical race theory, which is actually, you know, they're using that, as my spouse, who was an organizer, says, those three words are perfect for them, right? Critical race and theory to agitate their base, but they actually have nothing to do with what's actually going on. And these are parents that are alarmed, not well, and they're driven by politicians and dark money from the Kochs and others who fund groups like, what is it called? Parents Defending Education. But they are essentially attacking anything that would acknowledge that racism has been an issue in our history, or, you know, what any scholar of early America is not. It's non-controversial to say that the Constitution protected slavery. You know, so they're basically trying to deny students an honest education that looks at difficult parts of our history as well as, you know, inspiring parts. And I think part of the reason they're so determined to do that is because they're reacting to what happened in the wake of the murder of George Floyd, when huge numbers of Americans, including white Americans, felt like they could no longer look away from the fact that there is systemic racism in this country, and people really wanted to do something about it, and many still do. So this political right is trying to stop that, and the way they're trying to do that is to appeal to the most powerful emotion that any political movement could do, and that is parents' fear for their children's well-being. So they are weaponizing that and getting involved in these local school fights. You know, I'm sure that's going on in different communities in California. It's going on all around the country. So if any of your listeners are concerned about that or want to have resources to fend off what's being done in their communities, I would urge them to check out a new coalition that developed this past year called Learn From History. And it has a website, it's like learnfromhistory.org, but they have all kinds of resources. They have trainings, they have downloadable materials that will help people to again, fend off these attacks, to expose where they're coming from, and to remind the country that the vast majority of parents wants their children to learn honest history. Right. And they think it's important to reckon with the difficult as well as the encouraging elements in our history. So here again, you know, we have a place where the vast majority agrees, but where this political right that knows it's representing only a tiny minority, that most people don't want the world that these billionaires want to bring into being, the way they're making that happen is to weaponize fear and to weaponize prejudice. And so that's what we're seeing, these school board fights. So you're absolutely right that people should be looking out to those schools issues, and also, frankly, to volunteering or for local election administration and to running for the offices to ensure that election administration remains nonpartisan, you know, fair, accurate, and run with integrity. So those 2 points that you highlighted are really critical for people to think about, you know, seeing and what's going on in your local schools and being on the side of teachers trying to teach, you know, teach their subjects honestly and with integrity, and also supporting, you know, election administration with honesty and integrity.
Before we go to break, what you just mentioned was one of the key arguments in your book, and that is, if the James McGill Buchanans and the Kochs of the world were truthful about their philosophy and their end game, they wouldn't get votes. They would get a tiny minority. And so that's why they have to weaponize fear and prejudice.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, we're going to take a quick break. Today, we're joined by Nancy McLean, an award-winning historian and distinguished professor of history and public policy at Duke University. Her latest book is Democracy in Chains, The Deep History of the Radical Right's Stealth Plan for America. She writes about how over six decades, the radical right has worked to not only change who rules, but to fundamentally alter the rules of democratic governance as we know it. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we are marking the one-year anniversary of the January 6th attacks with Nancy McLean, author of Democracy in Chains, The Deep History of the Radical Right's Stealth Plan for America. Nancy McLean is professor of history and public policy at Duke University. And if you have any comments or questions about what happened that day, where we are, where we're going, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. How do you assess where we are right now? And what do you think it will take to really change the direction of voter suppression, gerrymandering, just the people wanting change and the politicians doing the exact opposite in so many cases? We'd love to hear from you. Nancy, can we talk about the racist elements of all of this? I also just wonder what you think about the media coverage of that. You know, I'm thinking about the black police officers who describe the racist attacks they faced on that day being called the N-word. I'm thinking about the photo of that man who walked with the Confederate flag through the Capitol. And then there is that study out of the University of Chicago, Robert Pape, professor of political science, basically says that what's so different about all of this is that the people at who took part in those attacks typically have no ties to right-wing groups. They're 95% white, 85% male. Many live near and among Biden supporters. And a lot of them live in places where the white population is declining. So can you just unpack that for us?
Yeah, there's a lot to unpack there, but I do think that that is a fascinating finding. And I have also read about that, that you know, quite a large proportion of these people who were involved in the insurrection in the Capitol, the people who have been arrested for that, and MAGA supporters more generally have been coming from communities that were long more homogenous and that are now becoming more diverse and having larger immigrant populations and populations of people of color. So they really, you know, in their emotional response to that, you know, aided again by Fox News and by others who frame newcomers as a danger, is a fear and a rejection and this notion of going back to an earlier America where they didn't have to, you know, think about learning to speak Spanish or dealing with people who saw things differently from themselves. So that is really important. But I think this larger issue too of the racism, and also, you know, so much of this is anchored in the religion right, which is so complicit with the billionaire libertarian right through groups like the Council on National Policy, you know. And if you think about it together, this kind of coalition has for years now been using this language that we remember well from Sarah Palin about the real Americans and the real America, you know, which Trump has just gotten a megaphone for, but it's been part of this Republican, you know, right turning Republican Party for some time now. So when they say that the election was stolen, That's obviously not, and you know, it's at odds with all of the facts. But the reason that so many can't be persuaded is that for them, this is an emotional truth, that if the country, which they think of as theirs and theirs alone, were operating properly, it would never have had a Black president. You know, it would never now have a Black vice president. And that emotional resistance to an America that's changing and becoming more inclusive is really part of what's happening here that makes believers in the MAGA, you know, kind of vision and ideas and supporters of Trump so resistant to facts, because you really can't persuade them. You know, and scholars have demonstrated that. You know, fortunately, it's not a majority of the country. Fortunately, it's not the whole Republican Party. But at this point, I believe the figures are 70 to 75% of Republicans now believe the big lie and think that Donald Trump won the election and that the election was somehow stolen from him. So that's how deeply this big lie reaches, and this desire to return to, and I don't think it's just a white America. I think it's a white Christian America, because there are no voters more loyal to the Republican Party and to Donald Trump than white conservative evangelicals at this point. So that needs to be part of the mix, too.
Were you surprised that Donald Trump got 74 million votes?
Yes. I think that we all were, right? Like, you know, and it's interesting because, you know, folks on the progressive side for years have been saying, you know, there are voters, you know, for the reasons that you said before, who haven't been turning out to elections because, you know, a lot of times they don't feel like what's happening in our politics is making a difference in their lives. You know, they're preoccupied with surviving and dealing with other challenges. And so they tune out. But Donald Trump was perceived as such a unique threat, and the COVID pandemic and the way his policies made it so much worse, that led 25 million new people to come out and vote on the Democratic side, you know, who hadn't been voting before. But it also led, I believe it was 15 million infrequent voters or first-time voters to vote for Donald Trump. So it really did become this kind of tribal thing. And I don't think, I certainly didn't think, you know, I began to, as I saw the way that they were mobilizing and, you know, canvassing when we were, most of us were obeying public health, you know, guidance not to do that for fear of spreading the virus. But anyway, they did manage to turn out all of these new voters. And those voters, I think, are the people who are really committed to this notion that Donald Trump was some kind of a savior for a country that is being lost. And maybe going back to some of our earlier discussion, too, about the fear mongering, you know, that we were talking about just before the break, and how, you know, the billionaires on the right could never get their agenda to go through if they said honestly, no, we don't believe in public schools. No, we don't think there should be Social Security. No, there should be no Medicare. Of course, there should be no Medicaid. You know, we can't do anything about the environment because we shouldn't be regulating corporations. You should have private Social Security and health accounts to take care of your needs. And where would you invest those with an unregulated Wall Street? I mean, it's so absurd. No one would ever vote for what they really want to do, you know, on the billionaire right. And so they weaponize, you know, as we're saying, you know, whether it's homophobia or transphobia or racism or, you know, using abortion, attacks on abortions to sound as though they're righteous, you know, so they do all that. But the other thing they do is use this boogie of socialism as a scare phrase, you know, to right. to entrench that MAGA minority and make them feel embattled. And what's interesting about that, for, you know, also as a historian, is I'm now reading stuff about works about the antebellum South for a new book that I'm working on. But one of the things that the most arch defenders of the Southern planter class said was that abolition was the first step on the road to socialism. Oh, so wow. This is fascinating because it's like in the 1830s. This is before Karl Marx ever writes a communist manifesto or before there are any kind of socialist parties. There aren't even really workers' parties of any kind at that point. And yet these Southern planter class arch defenders of slavery and of absolute property rights were saying, you know, abolition, regulating slavery is the first step on the way to socialism. So I don't know how you feel about that, but to me, to know how far back that boogie creature of socialism goes is really interesting. And it's interesting too, because then as now, the media didn't know to like ask these people, what do you mean by socialism? And you know, if you ask those libertarians what they mean by socialism, who are dangling that out as some fearsome thing, again, they think public schools are socialists. They think public libraries are socialists. They think national parks are socialists. They think the Social Security pension that is supporting your parents is socialist. They want to get rid of all those things. So I think it's really important to get off the defensive and the back foot and start taking the argument to them and asking hard questions of the other side, because I don't think that they can survive under withering scrutiny. It's almost like the Wicked Witch in The Wizard of Oz. You know, you could see them melting if we all knew, you know, what to say and what to ask.
Well, you bring up such a great point, because we keep hearing in the media, Republicans are going to take over the House this year. Okay, well, what does that mean? What are they offering the people? Don't just say they're going to take over, but what does that mean? What's their plan? And I mean, we know what their plan is, but let's talk about it.
It's always such a pleasure to talk with you, Rose. And it's so funny. I mean, as far as what's their plan, I don't know if you and listeners remember this, but in 2020, they weren't even going to have a platform. It was just reelect Donald Trump. Mm. And so they really didn't make a platform. You know, I'm not making this up. You can, you know, people can look it up. So no, they have no vision to do anything positive for the people. All they want to do is frighten people into voting for them out of fear, or they want to demoralize people and make us feel like it's a done deal and like they've already won. And that is so far from the truth, because all of those predictions about the party in power losing the midterms, you know, significantly and losing control of Congress are only true in normal times. We are not normal times, right? And so if the Americans understand the threat from this radicalized MAGA faction of the Republican Party to be as serious as the threat we saw from Donald Trump in 2020, which it is, because they're all kowtowing to him and the donors, then I think we can get people to mobilize for these midterms in the numbers needed so that we can stop all of these efforts to rig the rules. We can roll them back in various places, and we can push forward with this tremendously popular agenda. And, I know a lot of the mainstream media now just is full of stuff talking about Biden disappoints with this, Biden that, blah, blah, blah. But the truth is, the agenda that Biden is working for is the most progressive agenda that we have seen from a Democrat, you know, in a couple generations now. And what's blocking it is the thinness of the margins that the Democratic Party has in Congress. So many people make the analogy to like Franklin Delano Roosevelt or Lyndon Baines Johnson and what they were able to do, but they had huge margins. They had like 40 or 50 extra seats, more than they needed to pass those laws in the Senate. As your listeners well know, it's 50-50, and we have two corporate Democrats who are blocking the way to what the overwhelming majority of the people and the party wants in terms of things like the Build Back Better Act. So one true thing that Joe Manchin has said that I think we all need to keep in mind is he said, look, if you don't like me and what I'm doing, there's an easy solution. Elect more Democrats. Mm-hmm. And I think that that is true, that we should not let ourselves be in a position where the agenda supported by the overwhelming majority of the people is able to be blocked by one or two individuals. You know, so if we were to mobilize in large numbers and elect, you know, say five more Democratic senators, then we would have a much easier time getting getting this popular legislation passed. So, you know, again, I think we need to keep our eyes on the prize. We need to tune out some of the 24/7 news that can be just demoralizing and think, what can I do to move the agenda that I want forward? You know, given who I am, given the people I know, the resources I have, the talents I have, the passions, et cetera, that's when what's going to get us to where we need to go. Because we all need to remember, you know, Trump was predicted to win this election. All the pundits, all the poll, you know, was saying Trump was going to win. Ditto when Obama was running. You know, it looked like such a long shot. So we've got to keep our eyes on the prize and keep working and tune out the noise that's dispiriting.
Today, we are speaking with Nancy McLean, professor of history and public policy at Duke University. Nancy McLean is the author of Democracy in Chains, the deep history of the radical right stealth plan for America. Let's take a few callers who have been waiting patiently. Let's go to John in Daly City. Hi, John.
Hello. Thank you for letting me speak. I have a statement and then a question. The statement is, aren't you forgetting that one of the elements historically for this type of events is that loss. Revolutions start not with trying to gain, but they grow momentum on loss. Given that you have states, especially like Wyoming and Idaho and so on, with small populations, if the filibuster is changed, what would prevent it? The Republicans do take over the Senate the next term and are changing the voter laws throughout the country radically in the opposite direction. In other words, the crown jewel of what they're trying to achieve.
Thank you, John.
Yeah, thank you, John. Those are really, really important points. And you're so right that the fear of loss is such a powerful motivator. And often gain seems too abstract for people, but feeling like they're going to lose something can be very mobilizing. And we're certainly seeing, as you say, the power of that with the MAGA people who feel like they're losing, you know, the America of their vision, which is one in which, you know, men were fully dominant over their families and, you know, Christianity didn't have to, concede any space to Judaism, let alone Islam or atheism, you know, in which whites, you know, didn't have to accept co-workers or leadership from blacks or Latinos. So absolutely, there's that on the MAGA side. I think, though, on our side, there's a lot of that could be tapped as well, because certainly, you know, we're seeing with this Supreme Court now that, you know, something that was the settled law of the land for 50 years, Roe versus Wade, is very likely to be overturned. And for Americans of color, you know, there's so many ways in which they're feeling loss. I think for working class Americans, you know, whatever their race or background, you know, as hard as things are, they were once much worse before the New Deal. And people stand to lose a lot. They've already lost a lot, you know, since the 1980s. So I think conveying that could be a powerful mobilizer because, again, there's so much that hangs in the balance and we don't want to lose more. Your second point, your question, I think is a really important one about the filibuster. And, you know, the fact is that the vast majority of the population now is represented by only 12 U.S. senators. The minority of the population is represented by 88 senators. So that is a real issue, that the Democratic population has become so concentrated, you know, in a smaller number of states and within those states in a smaller number of cities. And the right is very self-consciously and explicitly, when they talk among themselves, taking advantage of that because we have a political system that's based on geography. And so if they can capture these rural areas and these lesser populated states, they can claim a lot of power that they would never get if things were decided on a majority basis. So I don't mean to diminish the significance of your point in any way about the filibuster. But what I would say is this, that McConnell was already, in effect, doing that. You know, he tore up Senate rules when he wouldn't let President Obama name a judge, a justice to the Supreme, not even nominate. They wouldn't even give hearings to Merrick Garland, much less, you know, a vote. So they have already violated the Senate rules in order to keep themselves in power. And the only hope that we have of turning things around is to pass the For the People Act and the John Lewis Act and to stop that rigging of the rules. So I agree with you that there is some risk involved. But what I see on the progressive side is that there's been a great stock taking, you know, in the last number of years. People are working together as never before, are thinking more strategically than ever before, are doing rural organizing, you know, are working to turn purple states blue and red states purple. So I agree that there is some risk, but I think it's a risk that we have to take at this point, because the risk of not doing it will absolutely bring worse consequences.
Well, thank you for the call, John. Let's go next to Alicia in Berkeley. Hi, Alicia. Thanks for holding.
Oh, thank you. And I just want to express my appreciation for your guest and her ability to make the ununderstandable a little more understandable. But I have two questions. One is, I was shocked when I heard the statistic that she mentioned a few minutes ago, that 75% of Republicans think that the election was fixed, because it seems like at least some of those people must have voted for Biden for him to get elected. And I'm just wondering what's happened between the time that Biden got elected and now that these people are, well, you know, for want of a better word, drinking the Kool-Aid. And then my other question is, does she have any suggestions for those of us who like to write letters and postcards and, you know, help as much as we can for elections in other states, as to what states we should target to get a Democratic majority enlarged?
Oh, you're wonderful, Alicia. Thank you. Thank you for that. You're so right in trying to work your way through those numbers and decipher what they mean. There's one piece of very encouraging news that has not gotten much attention, and that is that the Republican Party has lost a significant number of members. We don't know quite how many since the events of January 6th last year, but I saw something the other day, a report from Arizona. I believe it was 40,000 Republicans in Arizona canceled their party membership. I don't know if they became Democrats or switched to independents, but they left the Republican Party and they were motivated enough to go in, you know, to their county registration offices and do it on paper. So I suspect that's part of what's happening, that we might be dealing with a smaller whole number, you know, where there are, you know, ordinary voters. And I've certainly talked to many of them, and I'm sure you have too, who had, you know, been Republicans much of their lives, but who are scratching their heads saying, how did my party become this crazy? Mm-hmm. You know, I can't go there. And certainly we know there's that group of Republicans like that who have a website and kind of a news feed called The Bulwark, the kind of never Trumpers. So if you know people who are Republicans who are, you know, scratching their heads and trying to figure out what to do, you could recommend that, The Bulwark, it's called. But also I think that the bigger issue actually is the Fox News viewership and the people who get their news from Facebook. And there has been so much systematic disinformation there, and also so many efforts to activate a kind of tribal response so that facts don't matter, it's my team versus your team, that I think that helps to account for those high numbers of Republican voters who now believe the big lie. Personally, I'm hopeful that some of the extensive and I think impressive coverage of the January 6th insurrection and attempted coup, the coverage that it's getting this week, including on Rose's show here, that will help people to remember this. I think we need to remember January 6th like we do 9/11. you know, as a real hinge point of history, and not let it be forgotten, you know, as we go toward future elections. And we can all certainly be part of that. As to your wonderful question about, you know, if you live in a blue community and a blues in a sane state, you know, how can you help in other places? There's a great organization called Swing Left, and they have a website, and they are very strategic about identifying races that could make a difference in different states, and even state races within those states that could be important in changing the state legislatures. And they help connect people with, you know, phone canvassing. They'll have all the equipment for you to do that, but also for writing letters and postcards. So I would definitely recommend that to any listener who wants to help out in places where their efforts might go farther to change the national election. And again, it's called Swing Left.
Well, thank you for the call, Alicia. In about 30 seconds, Nancy, what are you hoping comes from the January 6th commission?
Wow. Yeah. Thank you. That is a really important question. Well, I have been following in particular Congressman Jamie Raskin, who I think is just such an extraordinary figure. He actually has a new book out this month because he suffered personal tragedy, a son's suicide, at the same time that the insurrection, just a few days before the insurrection in the Capitol. And he's been a leading figure on that January 6th House Select Committee. And I've heard him do a few briefings about what they're finding, and I think their work is really important. I just wish it could go more quickly. But what he said that I think is a helpful way to think about this is that there are three circles involved: a wider circle of larger numbers, less complicit, of MAGA supporters who came, you know, on the president's call and thought they were doing the right thing. Then within that group that was part of the insurrection, the kind of white power groups like the Proud Boys and others who trained militarily, who want to make this an insurrection, who would welcome a kind of civil war scenario. They were the ones who broke the windows and did the things that they did. And they're being found and prosecuted by the Justice Department. But Congressman Raskin has said, and I quite agree, the most dangerous is the inner circle. And those were the president and the people in his orbit, who we now know had a clear plan for a coup, effective, like what political science call it, a self-coup, to let himself stay in power. But that included, I know we don't have much time, so I won't go into the weeds, but advice from Federalist Society members, which of course is an organization funded by Charles Koch, Federalist Society members, for a strategy to pretend that this was legal by preventing the certification of the election by Congress, which would then throw, anyway, I think you, from what you said, we don't have time to go into all the particulars, but the coup plotters are the ones we must really pay attention to, because they are the ones who are now out in the states trying to drive those legal changes in the states that would make January 6th, 2021, not a one-off event, but in fact a trial run for a successful effort to seize power.
We'd love to have you back to talk about that. Nancy McLean is professor of history at Duke University and author of Democracy in Chains, The Deep History of the Radical Right's Stealth Plan for America. Thank you so much for your work, and thank you for joining us.
It's always a pleasure to talk with you and with your listeners, Rose. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And thanks to Kevin Vance for engineering today's show. Thanks to Leah Cesarine for producing today's show. Leah is sadly leaving Your Call. For the past few years, Leah has done an incredible job of booking and producing three shows in a row. That is a lot of work. It's been amazing to see Leah really grow in this position, finding fantastic guests, bringing in important information and facts, and really just taking charge. Thank you, Leah, for all of your great work. We will miss you, but we're excited about your next adventure. And Leah says she will miss all of you, especially our regular callers. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.